This episode of Court Junkie is brought to you by Sabda, the best way to find your new home. Sabda, Sabta.com. Hi, I'm Jillian, and you are listening to episode 2 of the Court Junkie podcast. In this episode, I'm going to be talking about the hearings that just occurred this week in the Melissa Kalusinski case. Now, I covered Melissa's case in episode 1, so if you haven't heard that yet or you're unfamiliar with the case, please go back and listen to that episode first. Trust me, it will make more sense if you do. So to recap, Melissa was arrested in January 2009 after a 16-month-old boy named Benjamin Kingan died while under her care at a daycare center in Lincolnshire, Illinois. Melissa was tried in November 2011 and was convicted of murder, and she's currently serving out a 31-year sentence at the Logan Correctional Center. As you'll recall, in June 2016, Melissa's trial judge, Judge Daniel Shaines, granted Melissa a hearing to present new evidence in the hopes of getting a retrial, or the very best case scenario, which would be having her conviction overturned with no retrial necessary. Melissa's attorney, Kathleen Zellner, who had just joined Melissa's team after her conviction and who's well known for her work in wrongful conviction cases, had filed a motion on the basis that newly discovered x-rays showed zero evidence of a skull fracture, which is what the state had argued at trial. She said that instead, there's evidence of a prior injury. I woke up at 5 a.m. on Thursday to get ready for Melissa's hearing. It was held at the Lake County Courthouse in Waukegan, Illinois, which is over an hour from where I live in Chicago. I got there at about 8:30, and as I went through security, I saw Melissa's family. Her father, her mother, her aunt, her uncle. They all had a nervous excitement about them, which, if I were to guess, might be excitement for Melissa to get this chance at freedom, and yet nervousness for it not to work out. I asked Melissa's mom how she was holding up, and she told me that she was just nervous for Melissa. To say that Melissa's family is friendly is kind of an understatement. They're not only really, really nice, but they're approachable and inclusive. They made sure to thank and talk to everyone who came to support their daughter. They have a warmness about them that just makes you feel like they're the kind of family who would make you feel at home if you ever came over for dinner, which in turn makes you feel absolutely awful that they're going through this horrible ordeal. No matter what your feelings are about this case or about Melissa's innocence or guilt, these people couldn't be more innocent. When I got to the courtroom, I was surprised to see that where we would be sitting was actually behind a glass wall, almost as if you're in an entirely separate room from the proceedings. Melissa's aunt had gone in first, and when she came back out, she too seemed a little surprised and told Melissa's mom that everyone viewing the hearing had to sit behind glass. Melissa's mom just sighed and said, "As long as I can see her, I'm all right." Cell phones weren't allowed in the courtroom, and neither was food, beverages, including bottled water, chewing gum, or buttons. One man walked in wearing a Free Melissa button, and before he could even sit down, a security guard was telling him to remove it. I took in the entire scene as I took a spot in the back row, next to Aaron Moriarty from 48 Hours. There were three rows, the first one being reserved for the family. And not only Melissa's family, but for Ben's family too. The Kingans were there too, and it was heartbreaking to watch them sit with their heads down during the times Ben's x-rays were shown on the big screen. I can only imagine how difficult that must be, and it serves as a reminder that there are just so many victims in this case. When Melissa walked into the courtroom, she smiled at her family and mouthed a hello as she was being escorted to her seat. I could tell they were ecstatic just to see her. Now, when I'm referring to Melissa's defense team, I'll refer to them as the petitioner instead of the defense, because in these hearings, Melissa is actually the petitioner since she's petitioning for a new trial. So on day one, the petitioner called four witnesses. They have a fifth witness who will be testifying too, but that won't be until September 16th on the final day of the hearing. The first witness was Paul DeLuca, Melissa's trial attorney. DeLuca is actually one of those attorneys who used to be a prosecutor. He prosecuted more than 75 homicide cases before defending more than 50 homicide cases. DeLuca testified that despite numerous requests to the Lake County Coroner's Office, he didn't receive the x-rays from Ben's autopsy until 2 months before going to trial. He said prosecutor Kristen Bishop gave him a CD with three JPEG images of Ben's x-rays on September 7th, 2011. There was a program on the CD that he was told to use in order to view the images. That program was called Tiger View, and it basically allows you to brighten and adjust x-ray images. DeLuca said he couldn't get the program to work, and from there, he said he didn't do anything else with the x-rays. He kind of just gave up on them. DeLuca said his whole trial strategy was based around the assertion that Ben had a skull fracture, which is what Dr. Choi, the state's expert and pathologist who performed the autopsy, had concluded. DeLuca said he had learned that Ben had an incident in late 2008, about 3 months prior to his death, in which he came home with a large bump on his head. And so the trial strategy was to show that Ben was a quote-unquote headbanger, i.e. a child who banged his head a lot. The plan was to prove that the October incident started the trauma and that that, plus the headbanging, caused a rebleed of chronic subdural hematoma. He said the strategy was revolved around trying to explain away that skull fracture. He also said he had no way to prove that there wasn't a skull fracture. Dr. Choi had testified that he had seen it with his own eyes, and another expert for the state, Dr. Montes, told the jury that he had gone to the coroner's office and physically examined the skull. DeLuca said he even went into great detail about how he touched the fracture with his finger and manipulated it. DeLuca said he had nothing to refute their testimony. Had he known that there was no skull fracture, he said he would have changed his trial strategy, his motions, his expert witnesses, everything. Even Melissa's confession. He said typically a confession must be corroborated and that he could have refuted Melissa's reenactment if there was no skull fracture. The petitioner's next witness was Paul Foreman, a former deputy coroner at the Lake County Coroner's Office. To say that Foreman's testimony was jaw-dropping might sound like I'm being dramatic, but it was pretty darn jaw-dropping. Foreman was present at Ben's autopsy on January 15th, and not only was he there, but he was the one who took x-rays of Ben's skull for Dr. Choi. He said the x-rays were clear and readable. After the autopsy, Foreman said he stitched Ben's body back up, including the skull. He said the next morning, he met with Dr. Montes, where they reviewed the autopsy report. He gave Dr. Montes the file and asked him to review it, but get this, he says Dr. Montes never saw the body. Remember that whole thing about how Dr. Montes testified at trial that he had felt the skull fracture with his own finger? Well, Foreman says that never happened. Not on the 15th, before he stitched Ben's body, and certainly not after. He told attorney Zellner that if Montes would have seen the body, Foreman would have been present for it. The third witness was Dr. Paul Zimmerman, an expert in pediatric neuroradiology. Dr. Zimmerman said he reviewed materials in the case, and he reviewed the quote-unquote new x-rays. He said that in his opinion, there was no fracture, which goes against abusive head trauma. He said the lack of a fracture points more towards self-inflicted or accidental trauma. Dr. Zimmerman also said he reviewed the x-rays on the disc that DeLuca had received. He said that the image quality was quote-unquote horrible and that he would fire whoever took them. He said the new x-rays would be sufficient in making a diagnosis and that there is not a skull fracture. No question, he said. He said in his opinion, Melissa's confession and reenactment don't match Ben's injuries. He also said that it's just not possible for someone to have felt a fracture and for it not to have shown up on an x-ray. The judge seemed a little taken aback by that statement and said, "It's rare that doctors say things are not possible, so I want to make sure I'm understanding you correctly. Did you say that it's not possible for a clinical observation of a fracture that did not appear on an x-ray?" And Dr. Zimmerman said, "Yes, it's not possible in the area we are talking about." Next up was the much-anticipated testimony of Dr. Thomas Rudd. As you'll recall from the last episode, Dr. Rudd was the coroner who switched the manner of Ben's death on the death certificate from homicide to undetermined. Dr. Rudd said he first reviewed Ben's case in December 2012, about a year after Melissa's conviction. Something felt off to him, and so he decided to discuss it with other pathologists. In May 2013, he said he reviewed the case with Dr. Nancy Jones, former Cook County medical examiner and who he called one of the most premier in the nation. Dr. Jones agreed with Dr. Rudd's assessment that Ben had died from a chronic or recurring event and not an acute or sudden event, as Dr. Choi had said. Dr. Rudd also testified about that infamous anonymous phone call. He said that on June 10th, 2015, he got a call from Paul Kelyzinski, Melissa's father, who told him that he had just received an anonymous phone call saying that there was a second set of x-rays that hadn't been introduced at trial. Dr. Rudd immediately called Michael Reed, a deputy coroner who handles x-rays, and asked him to send him any x-rays he could find from Ben's case. Reed gave him 5 images, and when Dr. Rudd reviewed them, he said he saw 0 evidence of a skull fracture. And that's when he changed Ben's manner of death to undetermined. Dr. Rudd also testified that he and Dr. Choi had a meeting to discuss Dr. Rudd's findings from the new x-rays. There was a membrane that was surrounded by old blood that Dr. Choi said he had thought was from when Ben was born, but Dr. Rudd told him that he thought it was a membrane that was indicative of an old injury. Dr. Rudd said Dr. Choi sent him a letter weeks later, saying that he had missed that old injury. On cross-examination, the state's attorney tried to make Dr. Rudd look as if he was using Melissa's cause as a platform, since he's up for re-election this year. They put up a photo on the overhead projector of Dr. Rudd at a festival called Gurney Days from last weekend. In the photo, Dr. Rudd is seen standing next to the Democratic nominee for state's attorney, and he's wearing a button that said, "Free Melissa." They brought up the fact that Dr. Rudd has spoken with the Chicago Tribune, the Sun-Times, the Daily Herald, the Lake County Chronicle, and even the, quote-unquote, tabloid show 48 Hours, which Aaron Moriarty didn't seem to appreciate too much. They pointed out that his campaign website has a link to the 48 Hours episode in which Melissa's case is featured. The petitioner rested their case after Dr. Rudd's testimony, pending the testimony of their last witness, Dr. Nancy Jones, which will occur on September 16th. And then it was the state's turn. They introduced their first witness and last one of the day. It was Michael Reed, who's a deputy coroner at the Lake County Coroner's Office. He's the one Dr. Rudd called for Ben's x-rays after receiving that phone call from Melissa's dad about that anonymous call. Reed said there were 4 x-rays in Ben's file. He used the TigerView program to make adjustments on the image of Ben's skull, and when he went to close out the program, instead of saving the image he had adjusted, it made a new version of it, leaving the original in the file as well. He exported the 5 images onto a CD. He said he told Dr. Rudd about the additional adjusted image and said he never told him that there was a, quote-unquote, second set of x-rays. On cross-examination, Reed said that the 5 images he had transported onto the disk were .tiff files and not JPEGs, which was what DeLuca had received. He said that he had gone on vacation in September 2011, and there was a chance that the x-rays computer could have been left open. So let's stop here for a second and talk about why all of this is important. I was there at the hearing, furiously taking notes in my little notepad during testimony, and sometimes things were confusing even for me, even though I was hanging on to every witness's every word. So Attorney DeLuca was given a CD with 3 x-ray images on them. All 3 were JPEGs. Normally, the x-ray images are in a .tiff format, so this means that someone would have had to save them as JPEGs before giving them to the defense. And why is this important? Because JPEGs are compressed files and can be of significantly less quality, too. So to put it bluntly, DeLuca received crappy x-ray images from the prosecution. When Reed went and made the adjustments to the .tiff version on the x-ray's computer, he accidentally created a new version with the adjustments that he made, making it look like a quote-unquote new x-ray. But this new x-ray was a lot clearer, especially when viewed as a .tiff file. And it's my understanding that both Dr. Rudd and Dr. Jones looked at this new image and made the determination that there was no skull fracture, but that there was evidence of a prior injury. On to day 2, another 5 a.m. wake-up call and another long drive up to the Lake County Courthouse in Waukegan. The state's first witness of the day was Matt DeMartini, the now former state's attorney who was part of the team that prosecuted Melissa. He said he looked at the x-rays in Ben's case, and he even met with Michael Reed to try and adjust them, but they were unreadable. And just as attorney Doug Johnson, attorney Zellner's partner, was cross-examining DeMartini, the power in the courthouse went out, and we were all covered in pitch-black darkness. Storms were passing through, so it was nothing nefarious, but I couldn't help but notice how calm everyone in the courtroom was. And I couldn't help but think that if there was a violent murderer in the room and the lights went out, people would probably be freaking out. I know I would be. But no one seemed scared of Melissa, the almost frail girl sitting there in her prison-issued jumpsuit with shackles on her hands, the girl who technically still has decades left on her sentence. The power came back on about 20 or so minutes later, and court resumed. The state called their next witness, a software engineer at the company that created TigerView, that software that enhances X-ray images. His name was Eric, and he was a smart guy who answered every question succinctly and confidently. He said the TigerView files typically export as .tiff files and not JPEGs, and that JPEGs can often be of lower quality since they're compressed images. He walked through the process of how you can make adjustments through TigerView and end up saving new versions, which is what it sounds like Reed did. Day two ended with Eric's testimony and left me with a ton of questions. Who saved those JPEG images and gave them to DeLuca? And why were they JPEGs at all? Why did Dr. Montez tell the jury that he had felt the skull fracture with his own hands if, according to Foreman, he never even saw the body? These questions, to me, do indicate the need for a retrial. The X-rays aren't necessarily quote-unquote new per se, and I do think the state showed that through Michael Reed and through the TigerView employee. The adjustments made and the file format were new, but that made them clear enough that Dr. Rudd, Dr. Jones, and even Dr. Choi said they now see evidence of an old injury. And not only do you have all of them saying that there's likely an old injury, but Dr. Montez, the doctor who told the jury that he felt the fracture, has now been challenged that he didn't even view the body. Let's face it, the jury may have well convicted Melissa based on the assertion that Ben had a skull fracture. The state said it more than 35 times in the trial, and if the jury believed that he had a skull fracture, and now there's incredible doubt that he ever did, the jury may have decided that there was too much reasonable doubt of her guilt. It calls into question Melissa's confession, too. The officers kept telling her over and over that Ben had a skull fracture. How did he get the fracture? They repeatedly asked her. Melissa appeared to be trying to make her story match with how Ben could have gotten a fracture. And if there was none, the jury may doubt her confession too. That's more than reasonable doubt, in my opinion. And I think that the experts need to battle out these new X-ray images. The jury needs to hear that Dr. Rudd and Dr. Jones both see no evidence of a skull fracture. And in fact, they see evidence of an old injury. The jury needs to hear that Dr. Choi admitted that he made a mistake in missing that old injury. And the jury needs to hear that Dr. Montez's opinion might not be as credible as they may have thought. On September 16th, Dr. Jones will testify and will undoubtedly say that she agrees with Dr. Rudd that, in her opinion, a prior injury caused Ben's death. And sometime after, we'll hear the judge's decision. After the hearing ended on Friday, I walked outside and spoke with a girl named Emily, who had been at both days of the hearing. Emily has a connection with Melissa's case, and that connection is Kathleen Zellner. Emily's fiancé is currently in prison, and Kathleen Zellner is his attorney, trying to get him out of prison.
I'm here to support the Kaluzinski family. I'm also a member of the Zellner family of wrongfully convicted people.
So Kathleen is representing your...
Yes, Kathleen represents my fiancé, Kent Pellegrini. He was wrongfully convicted of spousal rape.
Getting a conviction on spousal rape is rare. Kent's case is an interesting one, too, and it might just be in a future Court Junkie podcast episode. I asked Emily what she thought of the hearings.
So you like Kathleen?
Right? I love Kathleen. Yeah.
How do you think she did in the hearing?
Today... Kathleen is always prepared. She's over-prepared. She knows how the witness is going to respond, whether it's her witnesses or the state's witness. She knows how they're going to respond before she even asks the question.
Yeah.
She knows how to weave an argument. When she's doing an examination, you understand why she's doing it, why she's asking the questions, and you have a takeaway.
Right.
I feel like the state in there was struggling and grasping at anything they could, and the witnesses, their experts that they brought in, just have not really made any sense.
Emily said she drove up from Peoria, roughly a 3-hour drive, in a show of support for Melissa and her family. And Emily wasn't the only one. Melissa has quite a following of supporters who firmly believe that she was wrongfully convicted. And quite a few of them showed up at the hearings. Melissa's Aunt Helen runs a Facebook group in support of Melissa. It's called the Official Justice for Melissa Kalusinski Family Page. The group has 3,552 members as of this recording, and it seems to grow every day. The posters talk about the case, and they post words of encouragement to Melissa and her family. And as Melissa's aunt put it, the group itself is like a family. As I was walking to my car, I saw Melissa's family across the street, smiling, laughing, and waving at someone who was in the window on one of the upper floors of the courthouse building. I walked over to see who they were waving at. It was Melissa.
That's how I know that's her, because she does the double with the paper to get your attention. And she told me when I just talked to her on the phone, she's like, I can see mom and dad. Like,
oh, right there.
So that's how I know it's her.
That was cute.
That was, isn't it? She's right there.
That's adorable.
That's right there. Right there. Yeah, but she's doing good.
I can't wait till I can give her a hug.
It was a sweet moment. Melissa's dad was so excited that Melissa could see them from the window and that they could see her waving back at them. He did a goofy dance in the middle of the street for her. Melissa's mom, Cheryl, and her sister, Crystal, talked to me about how they're holding up and about how Melissa's doing.
So you're Melissa's sister, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And you're Melissa's mother.
Yes, I am.
And how are you guys doing?
Doing better now, oh, I think.
Yeah.
Very, very, yes.
Good. The hearings are going well.
Yes.
Yes.
Very good. And how is Melissa doing, do you know?
She's doing really well. She's very
She's
high
ready.
Hopes. She's ready.
Good.
That's what she keeps
Happy.
On saying. She's
good.
Ready.
And can you, like, what's Melissa like as a person?
Very nice and genuine person, like the happiest person, you know. She just likes to be around people, and she's very energetic and likes to just, you know, have a good time, like with your normal family.
Yeah, yeah.
She'd take the shirt off her back and give it to you.
Yeah.
That's what kind of a person she is.
And how often do you guys talk to Melissa?
Almost.
Every other weekend. We go down where she's at mm-hmm. every other weekend.
But phone call wise, she can call anytime.
Oh, right. That's good.
If she can get to a phone.
Yeah.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah. And she's not, after she's done working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if she has like a job in
there.
So after she gets out, what's like the first thing you want to do with her?
No. Oh, hug her.
Hug her?
Clobber her and then throw her in the bush like we used to do.
What she requests, she requests a lot of food, you know.
Yeah.
She requested pizza. She requested...
Oh, she's already told you?
Oh, she's already told us.
We already
and then, and then she's telling us she wants a big party, but with everybody that now sees what we've been saying for the past close to 8 years,
yeah.
that she didn't do anything.
Right, right.
People are believing her.
Yeah.
And people want to be there and greet her and just... You know,
yeah.
meet her and see what kind of a person she really is.
I was going to say, does she know how much support she's getting?
She does
from
now.
Everywhere?
Yeah. She does now.
Yeah.
Yeah, her mm-hmm. lawyer even tells her.
Her lawyer so. Tells her, keeps yeah. her in contact with everything.
Very cool. Because I noticed on the Facebook group, there's like people from Australia.
Yes.
UK.
And like everywhere, yeah.
Around really the world.
Around
yeah.
the world.
It is. Yes.
Very touching. Very,
and we're very happy on that.
Good.
Very happy on it.
As I was driving home, I found myself thinking about whether I truly believe Melissa is innocent. I wasn't there that day at the daycare, so I obviously can't say for absolute certain, but I can tell you that, yeah, I do think she's innocent. And at the very least, I think she deserves a new trial. Aside from the fact that two renowned medical examiners don't believe it was homicide, it's hard for me to think that this girl who had no criminal history, no known anger issues, no sort of seedy past or any indication of anything sinister would murder a 16-month-old boy. But what I believe doesn't matter. It's what the judge believes, and if there's a retrial, what the new jury will believe. And that does it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be attending Melissa's final hearing in September, so make sure you subscribe so you can get that update. The next Court Junkie podcast episode is going to be covering a different case, but if there are any additional developments in Melissa's case prior to the September hearing, I'll definitely let you know. If you want to read more about Emily's fiancé, Kent Pellegrini's case, please go to facebook.com/justiceforkent. A special thanks to our sponsor, Sabta.com, the best way to find your new home. Sabta, Sabta.com. If you like this podcast, please consider donating at patreon.com/courtjunkie. Any donations I receive will go towards the costs of hosting, producing, and editing this podcast, as well as allowing me to travel so I can physically go to these hearings and trials and then report back to you guys. Also, be sure to check out courtjunkie.com for some other interesting court cases and trials. And lastly, please leave some positive reviews on iTunes if you like this podcast. Thanks.